from Tukito LLC. It's Keto Woman Podcast with Daisy Brackenhall.
Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight, after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. Keto has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again, without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman Podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs to 20 grams or less per day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds, and the incidental carbs you find in things like dairy. Moderate protein, scale to your lean body mass, and then fat to satiety. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. I'll be asking my guest each week what their keto looks like to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we can't give you medical advice. It's always best to work with your own doctor because they know you and your medical history and so have access to the bigger picture. Thank you, Linda Riley, Brian Prince, Sherry Bastow, and Keto Christina for supporting me in this podcast by making a pledge at my Patreon page. Do you want to hear your name here at the top of the show? Are you enjoying this podcast and would like to help me make more episodes? Then head to my Patreon page at patreon.com/ketowoman or hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. It means a great deal to me, and you will get to headline the show just like Linda, Brian, Sherry and Christina did today. This week is a little different. I recorded this episode live at KetoFest with Amy Berger in front of an audience, and yes, it was terrifying. So if I sound a wee bit nervous, it's because I was. Regular listeners will know Amy from episodes 25 and 34. She always goes down a storm, so was the obvious extraordinary woman to ask to join me to record on Social Saturday. The dudes did a great roundup of KetoFest in this week's show over on their podcast, so I'm not going to go over all the details again, but I would like to share with you just a few of the highlights from my first ever KetoFest and first time in America. My travelling partner was good friend and first extraordinary woman Louise Reynolds, and we flew to America by way of a few days in Paris first. It was Lou's first time in Paris, and I really enjoyed showing her around my favourite city. We happened to be there for probably the biggest weekend of this year, as it was both Bastille Day and the Football World Cup final. France won, of course, and the city was a riot of joyful fans who all seemed to take to the streets to celebrate at once. On to America. New York briefly, and then on to New London and KetoFest preparations. I was so looking forward to meeting everyone, and every single person surpassed my expectations. It really is like meeting old friends for the first time, as Richard says. It was wonderful to finally meet the two keto dudes in person. I've worked with Richard and Carl now for nearly 2 years, and I'm not exaggerating when I say they've changed my life. This podcast is produced by them, as you know, and I absolutely love doing it and getting to meet such extraordinary people each week. It was an honour to get to squeeze my friends and mentors in person. My fellow admins, the KetoFest Dream Team, are the most hard-working, dedicated, wonderful, amazing people you could ever hope to meet, and I'm so thankful to have them in my life. As Kim said, we are keto family, and I love them dearly and miss them terribly. My main role over the weekend at KetoFest was looking after the podcasters on Saturday and then the speakers on Sunday, when I was the MC at the Isaac School. What a fantastic lineup we had there. Alan Meisner, Megan Ramos, Dave Feldman, Siobhan Huggins, Nick Mailer, Peter Ballastet, Amy Berger, and Amber O'Hearn. I have to just make a quick aside here to congratulate Siobhan on her fantastic debut presentation. I was so proud to have been able to introduce her, and she wowed the crowd with a truly engaging, entertaining, and interesting presentation. A highlight of working at this venue was that I got to do so with the editor-producer I work with on this podcast, Brandon. I won't wax lyrical about him too much, though, because he might just edit it out. My time in New London was also a tale of two ice creams and candied ginger, two of my most favourite things. You might remember Austin Archibald, who was my first extraordinary man in episode 8, way back in December, who told us about his Kickstarter campaign to launch Rebel Ice Cream. Well, launch he did, and brought about 80 pints to KetoFest to make his debut. I got to taste all the flavours and particularly liked the peanut butter fudge. You can now order direct from the website rebelcreamery.com. Rebel Ice Cream stands out amongst low-carb ice creams currently on the market for its ingredients, which are very keto-friendly. The sweeteners used in the ice cream are erythritol and monk fruit, so will have mass appeal, I think, amongst ketonians. The only downside of using these is that you really do need to leave the ice cream to soften a while from the freezer before you can scoop it. So some patience is required, which is a tough ask when it comes to ice cream, especially in my house. I did find all but the peanut butter flavour a little bit too sweet. But I also think when it comes to sweetness that no manufacturer will ever be able to keep everyone happy. What is just right for my taste buds will not be sweet enough for somebody else and too sweet for yet another person. So all in all, I think it's a really good ice cream. I have to mention Keto & Co, who are running the ice cream social. I didn't get to try their soft serve ice creams, but heard from other people that they were pretty good. So what was the second ice cream? Well, I got to try five different flavours made by the one and only Carrie Brown in her new kitchen. Kim, Siobhan and I drove over to her new place in Connecticut and met the woman herself and her three lovely felines, Mr. McHenry, Daisy and Zebedee. I'd only recently recorded an episode with Carrie and we ended up talking for a further 2 hours, so we were already mates before we met in person. This is ice cream to knock your socks off. It does contain xylitol. No substitutions, I will forever have ringing in my ears in Carrie's voice, which I know not everyone gets on with, but it does mean that you get an ice cream that scoops perfectly straight out of the freezer. But that's just a small part compared to the flavour explosions. Wow! I really do recommend getting Carrie's book, which is called The Keto Ice Cream Scoop. It not only has 52 flavours, but also a really useful introduction, which goes through the gadgets and utensils and ingredients she uses and why it's important to stick to the recipes and not mess with them. It's also a very entertaining read, and you can really hear her personality coming through the words. I'm a shocker for messing with recipes, so this time I'm going to stick faithfully to them for fear of her voice berating me in my head. I'll let you know which ones I try first, but certainly the ones she made for us were utterly delicious. So how on earth do you ketofy candied ginger? I've seen a recipe using erythritol, but I have my doubts as to how it will turn out, so I've never tried it. So when I heard that Jennifer Kleiman was bringing candied ginger made using allulose to KetoFest, I was a tad excited. Let me tell you, it's delicious. Fiery hot and just sweet enough without being too sweet. The only problem I had was sticking to the serving size, which went completely out the window. You can find out more about Jennifer's candied ginger, and she also does candied lemon and orange peel, at Moonsgrove Farms on Facebook and at moonsgrovefarms.com. So watch those spaces for news about when you can order your own to try. It really is very delicious and truly hit the spot I had been missing since starting keto. There's one more foodie place I have to give a shout out to, and that's Hot Rods. Rod kindly set up a party room for 40 or so KKBs to meet up for dinner on social Saturday evening and laid on a fabulous taster platter of wings, ribs, shrimp, sausage and bacon. who can go without bacon, right? And it was really good bacon, I have to say. If you happen to be in New London before the next Keto Fest, go grab some dinner at Hot Rods. I don't think you'll be disappointed. We will most definitely be having our dinner there again next year. And a special thanks also to Karen for all her help organising things there last minute. I'll round up by saying just how very fabulous it was to meet and hug the Facebook kick-ass keto bitches who were at Keto Fest. You are such an amazing group of women, and it's a real honour to know you all. People talk about finding your tribe. It's one of those phrases, isn't it? Well, now I really get it. The two keto dudes and Brandon, the fabulous volunteers and all the people at Keto Fest, the KKBs and my keto family. You are my tribe, and what a tribe it is. Welcome to the Keto Women Podcast. It's a special episode here today because we're recording live from Keto Fest in New London, Connecticut. And I've got a very special guest with us here today, Amy Berger. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to take questions from the audience, but I think Amy wants to start off with a bit of ranting, things that annoy you, things you'd like to get out there for everyone.
No, I wouldn't say it's ranting. I would say, I've been looking for a long time to find my niche in low carb and keto. There's so many bloggers and so many podcasters and so many people in this now, which is great. But I've sort of identified what I think my role might be, and it's taken a long time to shape it and to come to this realization. I think that my role and the role that I would like to assume is being a voice of calm and sanity and rationality. Is that a word? Rationality? Or a voice of reason? Because even in some of the questions that I hear being asked, every question is legitimate. I think it's true that there's no dumb questions, but when I get emails from prospective clients, I can literally feel the anxiety and the fear and the worry radiating out of the screen. And like Dr. Berry was saying, just stop eating carbs. That's 90% of this. The omega-3, omega-6, the fasting, the protein, everything else is just details. What's going to get you the vast majority of the way to where most of us want to go is keeping carbs very low. And The beautiful thing about keto or low carb or Banting, Atkins, whatever name you like to use for it, is that the beauty of it is its simplicity. It's not supposed to be this complicated. The beauty of low carb, at least in my opinion, is that you never had to count and weigh and measure and track. You just eat really, really little carbs and everything else kind of works out. And maybe, yeah, there's gonna come a time and a place where some people need to tweak things, but again, to compare this to something like Weight Watchers or some other plan where you're kind of required to keep track. I mean, I love food. I love to eat. I love to cook. I love grocery stores. Math doesn't belong at the dinner table, in my opinion. I don't want to bust out my spreadsheet. I don't want to bust out my calculator. And no judgment against people who do. There's people that genuinely enjoy that. I don't. And I think it sucks the fun out of this. Out of the fun, out of delicious food, and it adds a layer of complexity that I think for most people doesn't need to be there. You know, some people ditch the carbs and they never look back. And for some people, it's every day is a struggle. Every day, I've been doing keto 5 years. I still want that bagel. When is this craving going to go away? And I just think all of that math adds a layer of difficulty that makes what is for some people already difficult even harder. And when people are brand new, I don't have them do any of the math. I'm like, just stay under this amount of carbs. Here's what you can eat. Here's what you can't eat. Come back to me in a couple of weeks, and we'll see where things are. So I don't know if that's a rant or that's just I actually like feel tired listening to people worry and spin the wheels because it's. The beauty of this is that it doesn't have to be that complicated.
That's what's upsetting. That's what upsets me for something, a way of eating that is so joyful, is so delicious. And when I see people getting really stressed about it, it upsets me because they don't need to be.
And people are afraid to stop tracking. I understand. It's not that I don't understand the, you know, sort of mental, psychological need to track. I mean, when you've been told your whole life that you have to eat a certain amount or not exceed a certain amount of food or a certain amount of fat or carbs or what have you, I understand the need to do it, but a lot of the people who write to me come to me for troubleshooting. They've been doing keto or low carb for a certain amount of time and they're not getting where they want to go. And I have to kind of remind them, okay, you've already been tracking and weighing and measuring and you're not getting the results you want. Are you willing to try to wrap your mind around not doing that since you're already doing it and it's not working? And maybe the answer is they do still need to weigh and measure. Maybe they're weighing and measuring the wrong things, or they're chasing, you know, well, I thought I was supposed to eat 80% fat. And, you know, maybe that does need to be changed and they can still track. Like Dave Feldman is such a dear friend of mine, but I'm so the opposite of somebody like Dave. Like, he loves to track. He gets blood tests every 5 minutes. You will just never see me doing that. And I have every ounce of respect for that kind of, he's literally rewriting the paradigms. And we need people like that in our world. But I try to take the stuff that he does and the stuff that the researchers do and translate it into plain English for the people that are going to come to me that are never going to read Cholesterol Code. They're never going to read Tom Seyfried's book. You know, let me explain this all in layman's terms. I don't know.
I think that the danger often is as well, if you're in that tracking mode and if you're wanting to go by these numbers that you've set up for yourself, or somebody else has said that you should be eating so much protein, so much fat, so many carbs, and you follow that religiously, you kind of forget to listen to just what you feel like eating that day. So you might eat breakfast when actually you'd rather skip it because that's in the plan. Or, you know, your dinner has to be a certain quantity of certain foods because it's in the plan. Whereas sometimes maybe it's just better to forget that for a while and actually just listen to how you feel, how you're feeling. Are you hungry? Is your mood not as good as it was?
What is this madness you're speaking of? To listen to your body? What? Where did that come? I mean, I don't know if you guys follow Sean Baker. He's kind of spearheading the carnivore movement. He's very controversial. I don't know that I agree with everything he does, but one thing he says that I think is really simple yet profound is, because everybody asks if he fasts, you know, how many meals a day does he eat? And he said, when I'm hungry, I eat. I think we were given an appetite for a reason. If you're hungry, you probably need some nourishment. Your body is telling you, I need some food. The difference of being able to listen to your body and to trust the signals, because Kim was talking about that in the previous, you know, recording, to be able to trust the signals that your body's giving you, I think your body will give you the quote unquote correct signals when you're eating a species appropriate diet. When you're not having false hunger due to blood sugar highs and lows and insulin highs and lows, when your sort of metabolism is corrected, I think you can trust, because you're not gonna get hungry 26 times a day. You know, but I think fasting is one tool in the toolkit, but like you were saying, you know, people, I'm gonna eat this much because that's what my macro says and that's what the calculator I used says I should eat, versus I'm not hungry, I'm not going to eat at all. Or, well, I'm supposed to fast for 8 more hours, but I'm really hungry, I'm crabby, but I have to keep... No, you don't have to keep fasting. Eat. Don't eat a donut. Eat some hard-boiled egg. You know, that's
the thing. It's a slight chicken and egg thing, isn't it? You have to follow a bit of a plan to start with, because you've got to get your body to a place where it's going to give you the right signals.
Yes.
But
yes.
Once you're there, then you can just listen to what it's saying and go with that.
That's what I think. The human body is not a calculator and it's not a computer. I wish it was. We all wish it was, because if it was, then yeah, I'm going to program in 18 grams total carbs, 100 grams of protein, 100 grams of fat. Like if there was a mathematical formula that I could say, eat exactly this much fat, exactly this much protein, exactly this much carb, and you will lose exactly this much weight and exactly this much time, A, I'd be out of a job. B, I don't know if there is a B, but I wish it were that simple. I mean, if it were that simple, none of us would even be here. none of us would need keto. We would have figured this out 20 years ago. We'd be at our ideal body weight, and we'd be off having fun. I mean, I'm having fun right now, but I mean, I think that people don't understand that it doesn't work. That the numbers, any macro, and I, that word is like nails on a chalkboard to me, but any sort of mathematical formula you get from whatever calculator you find online is only a guideline. It's a ballpark. It's not gospel. It's not passed down, written in stone. It's a place to start and then see if it's working or not. I don't think there is a mathematical formula that can tell you how much weight or how much fat you're going to lose or how much, you know, if I run on a treadmill for this amount of time, like the calorie meters on those cardio machines crack me up. Even if it asks, sometimes it asks for you to put in your age and your body weight. So, whoop-de-doo. If, let's say me and Daisy are the same age and the same body weight, if we do the exact same exercise and eat the exact same food, guess what? Probably not going to have the exact same effects, right? Our blood sugar is going to be different. Our ketones are going to be different. The weight change is going to be different. And that's really, really frustrating, but it's just the beauty of the human race and the human body.
There's also the assumption, of course, that if you're working to these macros, that what you're eating is what it says on the packet. Because they can't be completely correct. They must always at least be an average. Example, the bacon I buy in France, I always look for the one that has the most fat. But there are packets on there that are really lean as well. So the nutritional statistics can't be correct for all of them. So if you're working to really precise figures, you're actually not working to really precise figures because they can't be.
No, I'm glad you said that because I understand, again, the tracking and the using, you know, MyFitnessPal or FitDay. It's, again, it's a guideline because even if, let's say you have two green peppers and one was grown in Canada in a greenhouse, one was grown 6 miles away from my house in somebody's garden, the soil conditions are different. Do those two peppers have exactly the same amount of vitamins and minerals? And same thing with a steak or a piece of pork or chicken. Okay, this pig was raised on this kind of farm and given this kind of feed. This pig was raised on a very different kind of feed. Do they have the same nutrients? Or like, okay, 6 ounce steak, 1/8 inch cap of fat, and you try to customize it as much as you can, but it's never going to be exactly perfect. And so it can't be exact. It's always just a ballpark. I like those trackers crack me up. How do you know how much vitamin A is in this food? How do you know exactly how many calories were in my 4 ounce filet mignon versus somebody else's? Because that one had slightly more fat. I'm just not a numbers person. I don't know. I'm a writer. I was a humanities major.
Why don't we take a question from the audience?
The question asked is from someone who has been ketogenic for over a year, but he still sometimes has sugar and carb cravings to deal with. He asks how best to figure out when he is physically hungry versus when he simply has head hunger. Is it a satiety issue or more of a habitual emotional one?
Yes, a great question.
I have some thoughts. Do you have any thoughts?
I know I really suffer big time from head hunger. So I can be hungry, especially if I'm at home. If I'm busy, I can go all day and I haven't eaten and I've completely forgotten and I'm not hungry. If I'm at home and I'm near the fridge, I'm snacky. I'm a real snack monster all day and I just want a snack and I feel like I'm hungry and I keep needing to pick at something. But obviously I'm not, because when I'm out working hard gardening, you'd think I'd need more fuel, but I don't. I don't get hungry then. So that's definite head hunger in it. And it's a real problem for me. And I haven't found the solution yet. I think getting it as strict as possible and taking out the things that I like to snack on, which for me are things like nuts and cheese and the sweet treaty type things. And so I still enjoy those, but I try and keep them out of the house in general and have them at the weekends or when I have friends coming over for dinner or something like that. So I kind of have to force myself into a bit of a routine to deal with it. I haven't found a way that it just switches off, unfortunately.
Well, you say unfortunately, but maybe I'm just too nice and too relaxed and too understanding, but I think there is some degree to this of, you know, if you've been doing low carb or keto for a while and every now and then you still have cravings or you still get that sort of, I'm going to use the word hypoglycemia. It may not be actual hypoglycemia, but you get that feeling of shakiness, like, I've got to eat something. I don't think there's anything wrong with you. If that still happens, it doesn't mean you need to keto harder. It doesn't mean you're doing something. It means you're human and you have a human body and you have a human brain. And, you know, blood sugar is affected by so many things besides what we put in our mouths, that there could be something else going on that is triggering that kind of craving or that kind of sense of hunger. But in terms, so I guess I'm just, it doesn't make anyone a bad person. If you've been doing this for a long time and every now and then you still have a piece of whatever, all right, no big deal. We still love you. but with the hunger, for me to distinguish between that sort of sugar hunger and false hunger versus actual need for nourishment, I ask myself, would I eat a pork chop and asparagus right now, or do I want a cookie? If the answer is cookie, it's brain sugar hunger. If I, man, a pork chop really sounds good right now, and that pile of broccoli, man, I could really go for that. That's hunger. Because when you want the donut and the cookie, you have zero desire for a prime rib with blue cheese melted on top of it, even though any other time, that prime rib and blue cheese, you'd be all over it. If you don't want it, but you'd snark down a donut in 2 seconds, I think that's my distinction. And I'm not going to lie. It doesn't always work for me, quote unquote, work. Like, you know, sometimes I'll have the sweet thing, or sometimes it's fake sweet. You probably all saw me put the sweet low in my coffee. I'm not a food purist. I do use artificial sweeteners. I don't think it makes you a horrible, bad, worst keto person ever to use Splenda or to use Sweet and Low or Stevia. You know, shush, they might kick me out of the club, but...
Jennifer asks Amy to give us an update on her hypothyroidism story.
Yeah, sure. So if anyone in the room didn't hear what she said, I am taking medication for hypothyroidism. Medication was my last resort. I did try several other things to do this myself, to do it naturally. I wish that I hadn't. I wish that I had gone right to the medication, because I could have spared myself 3 years of severe, severe chronic constipation, crippling depression. There's a reason you didn't see me at Keto Fest last year, and it's because I was too depressed and I didn't want to socialize. I didn't want to put on real clothes and go meet other humans. I wanted to stay home by myself all the time. And so many other, the hair loss, weight gain. I had gained about 17 or 20 pounds with no change to my diet. And it was in the middle of low carb. I've been low carb for a very long time. So it wasn't, I don't think it was low carb that triggered the hypothyroidism, because why would it have started 10 or 15 years into my journey and not 2 years? So certainly there are people who have hypothyroidism that start a ketogenic diet and it gets better. They can actually reduce their medication or get off the medication. That seems to happen more so with Hashimoto's. I don't have Hashis. Mine is not autoimmune in nature. So I think it kind of runs the gamut. Keto is good for thyroid, bad for thyroid. I don't think it's ever bad for thyroid. In one of the blog posts I wrote, what I see is some of the women, because it's almost always women, who report a thyroid problem after going keto, is they're actually just starving themselves unintentionally. They're eating very, very low calories, especially when they combine it with over-exercising. They're over-exerting themselves. They're not refueling enough. Because like Kim was saying in the previous recording, we've been told exercise more, eat less. So you do that, and why does it surprise anybody when your metabolism absolutely shuts down? That to me is not a mystery at all. But with my personal situation, I'm probably feeling better now than I have in I couldn't tell you how long. And I do think it's the medication. And I'm guilty of this too. We get very anti-medication in the keto world. You know, keto should fix everything. If you still need that medication, well, what are you doing wrong? You're eating, you know, well, let me look at your macros. I think sometimes we just need help. And maybe it is a cop-out. Maybe I could have changed something that I didn't change, but I spent 3 years and a lot of money and a lot of tears, and I would never wish that upon anyone. So I'm doing great. Thank you for asking. And I will add on to that. I think that hypothyroidism is massively under-recognized and underdiagnosed because I see it all the time. Again, mostly in women. It does happen to men, but mostly I see it in women. And I see it because I kept saying, God, is hypothyroidism as common as this, or what's going on? And then somebody pointed out to me, well, Amy, the people writing to you are writing to you because they're struggling. If they were doing well, if they were losing the weight, if they were happy with the results they were getting on keto, they wouldn't be writing to me. So, of course, the people that are going to write to me are going to be disproportionately people that have some type of hormonal imbalance or some other underlying problem that hasn't been identified. And I think, you know, I won't get into the details here. You can look on my blog, but if you've only ever had your TSH measured and your doctor says your thyroid is fine,
yeah,
new doctor time.
For sure.
Yeah.
The other thing that I see advice given quite a lot for people who have hypothyroidism is that you need to up your carbs, that you shouldn't be eating low carb, that there's this minimum that you need to reach. If you're struggling on keto, the first port of call seems to be get your carb level up. What do you think about that? Because for me, I don't agree. It doesn't seem to work that way for me. But
I want to not agree also, but I support whatever works. And I know that's kind of wishy-washy, but if somebody adds back more carbs and feels better,
oh, for sure,
then they feel better.
As a
general rule, I would really look into the diet because I think they're just under-eating. I really do. They're under-eating. We're so afraid to stop exercising. When I don't know if anyone here has ever heard of Paul Check, but Paul Check has this thing where he says, he doesn't call it working out, he calls it working in, you know? Like, it's okay to get off the treadmill. It's okay to get off the Stairmaster because you may be actually perpetuating the cycle by continuing to do that. You know, I've never heard of someone who was, you know, had morbid obesity and had type 2 diabetes. I've never heard anyone in that situation report that when they went keto, they had adrenal fatigue or their thyroid crashed. You don't hear that. You hear that from the women who are already either at a healthy weight or maybe only very slightly overweight, over-exercising again. Sometimes they're moms, they have kids, they're the type that their stress level is like, ah, you know? It doesn't surprise me that their body doesn't let them keep doing that. It's a survival mechanism. Your body's like, you won't slow down. I'm going to force you to slow down by making you tired and depressed and constipated and cold. Because you won't do it yourself. I'm going to make you not be able to get on the treadmill again. So the carbs, because some people do report that they feel better with more carbs. Now, we're not talking about like 250 grams of carbs a day, maybe a sweet potato one, you know, even every day or something. But the thing is too, and again, totally unpopular for me to say this, not everybody needs to live in ketosis all the time. Not only do some people have a higher carb tolerance, but if you're literally talking like one sweet potato a day with dinner, to me, that is still absolutely a low-carb diet. It might not be a medically therapeutic ketogenic diet. It's definitely still low-carb. And there's people who can eat 60 or 70 grams of carbs and still be in ketosis. So that's the thing. Not everybody, but some people have a higher carb tolerance. So I think I so much like to emphasize the phrase low-carb rather than keto. Because that also helps people, I think, not be so afraid of carbs. And like when we talk about adding carbs back in, I'm not saying start your day with, you know, pancakes and orange juice and a biscuit and a scone with jam on it. Maybe you have, I don't know, a wedge of cantaloupe or, again, like for dinner, some sweet potatoes, some parsnips, some beets, butternut squash. That was the really long answer to say, I don't think most people need more carbs, but if somebody does do better that way, then they do better that way.
Then that's fine. Absolutely. Karen, I know you had an interesting question.
Karen's question is about her 70-year-old mother who has been on thyroid medication since her mid-20s. Recently, her doctor put her on a statin, which Karen really is not happy about. What kind of effect is the statin likely to have on her mother's thyroid function, she asks. And are there any symptoms she should be looking out for?
I'm not a physician, so I actually don't know if statins affect the thyroid. I know that one of the signs of hypothyroidism is very elevated LDL. And I get a lot of clients coming to me who are on statins when they're hypothyroid. And I said, what? Why are you on a statin? You're not even on thyroid medication. They should fix the thyroid. That's going to take care of the LDL. Never mind that the whole LDL thing is not what we think it is, and high LDL is not a disease that needs to be treated anyway. Looking at the mechanisms by which statins work, it wouldn't surprise me if they affect just about everything. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if there's some organ or gland that is affected by statins that they haven't identified yet. But I mean, to hear, again, I'm not a physician, but to hear an older woman put on a statin is like nightmarish to me, because it has been shown over and over again that high cholesterol is not only beneficial as we age in general, but especially for women. None of these statin trials were done on older women. I mean, I come to my talk tomorrow, I'm talking about Alzheimer's disease. Higher cholesterol over and over again is beneficial for reduction in mortality. I mean, everybody's going to die. We all have 100% risk of mortality, but it just, you know, your chance of dying from anything other than a nice old age. Higher cholesterol seems to be beneficial for that, definitely beneficial for cognitive function.
Karen says that she has noticed in the last few months that her mother has been getting very forgetful and has even said to her that she feels like she's losing it, and she knows it. Karen would like her to come off the statins, but says that her mother is of the generation that does what the doctor tells her to do without question.
Well, her doctor told her, and that's fine. I'm not a physician. I don't make recommendations regarding medication. But, there's a slide in my talk. You can go to the FDA's website, the Mayo Clinic website, and they list very clearly memory loss, confusion, cognitive impairment is well-known, well-documented side effects of these drugs.
Karen points out that her cholesterol is much higher than her mother's, but she hasn't been told to go on a statin.
So, I mean, she can find a new... Where do you live? Maybe there's a keto-friendly doctor in your area.
Her mother lives in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk to Carl Franklin. He might know of somebody that is in the area.
I have a perfect illustration, actually. A friend of mine in the UK, his mother is 93 and has been on statins for a while. And yes, had dementia, very forgetful, all the things that you were saying. And he saw the figures and, taking into account her age, said, you know, I don't think you should be on these. You know, your cholesterol numbers weren't even that high to start with before they put you on them, even though we all know that's debatable in the first place. She came off them, and okay, she hasn't gone back to getting rid of that dementia completely, but apparently the change was profound in a very short space of time. And so actually she didn't have dementia. She shouldn't have been on the statins. So yeah, I mean, I'd be very worried too.
This question is asking Amy to comment on how diet impacts Alzheimer's and the significance of the APOE4 gene.
Yeah, so I will be talking about this tomorrow. I'm speaking tomorrow at 3 if anybody wants to come to that talk. But the nutshell version is the APOE4 gene is believed to be the oldest of the APOE alleles, the variants, in the human family. It's the most simian, most ape-like, if you will. And so it was forged in our hunter-gatherer times. And it is, so APOE4 does not cause Alzheimer's disease. Plenty of people who have two E4, homozygous for E4, don't develop Alzheimer's. And millions of people who do have Alzheimer's don't have even one E4 gene. They're 2-2, 3-3, 2-3. The E4 is, nobody's genetically programmed to get Alzheimer's. The E4 is simply the worst match for the modern diet and lifestyle. It's the worst match for the high carb, high vegetable oil, you know, not moving enough type of diet and lifestyle. And so in terms of the diet recommendations that I make, low fat can work for some people. I don't think it's the ideal way to go. I think what you do have to do as an E4 is manage your glucose. And I say this for any genotype, but especially for the E4s, what you do have to do is manage your glucose and insulin over the long term. Whatever diet composition helps you accomplish that is what you need to do. For some people, that's going to be keto or low carb. For some people, it's going to be more of a Mediterranean, maybe 40% carb. What you have to do is control the blood sugar and the insulin. The E4, they seem to, even if they say higher fat, like if you read Dale, I don't know if you read Dale Bredesen's book, they're very anti-saturated fat, specifically for the E4. So they would tell you more olive oil, more nuts and seeds, avocado, salmon, whatever. If that works, it works. But I think the reason they recommend the lower saturated, specifically for the E4s, is because the problem, quote, with the E4s is that when they eat a high fat diet, what happens? The cholesterol shoots through the roof, right? And all those people have massively increased risk for Alzheimer's, massively increased risk for heart attack, stroke, other cerebrovascular, cardiovascular events. But what else are those people eating? A lot of bread, a lot of sugar, a lot of soda, a lot of Skittles. Have they ever done a long-term study in E4s on a low-carb diet, with or without a lot of saturated fat? When you take away the pieces of the modern diet that are the worst mismatch for the E4 genotype, I think you take away the risk. But I don't know for sure. I'm speculating based on my understanding of the literature. Look at Dave Feldman. I don't know if Dave Feldman has stratified his research yet into the E4s versus the other genes, because if he does, it would be fascinating to see if even some of these lean mass hyper-responders, total cholesterol 400, 500, LDL over 200, if any of those are E4s and what happens to them 20, 30 years from now, my hunch would be that they're going to be totally fine and they're not going to have Alzheimer's disease. In Nigeria, there's tribes in Nigeria that have the world's highest incidence of ApoE4. And you know what they don't have? Alzheimer's disease. Because they're not eating Twinkies. And they're not drinking Mountain Dew. But again, that's my guess. I don't know if anyone knows for sure. If I was an E4, I would do a low-carb diet. That's what I would do myself.
You had a question there. You had your hand up. Oh.
Jennifer asks Amy's opinion on eating carbs seasonally. She mentions how Chris Masterjohn criticizes the ketogenic diet and says that because it is a low insulinogenic diet, you will have low insulin production. So if you don't exercise thyroid production much, it will lead to hypothyroidism. He recommends eating seasonally along the lines of whole food paleo.
Seasonal carb eating, kind of like an evolutionary, mirror our evolution that, at least at certain latitudes in certain geographical areas, we would have had more tubers, more fruit at certain times of the year. My answer is I don't know. I don't know enough about that mechanism or how maybe periodic insulin infusions, if you will, would help the thyroid. I don't think I may be like in the minority here. Carbohydrate per se is not poison. You can actually eat beets and not die 5 minutes later. You can eat butternut squash and not keel over. Now, if you have raging type 2 diabetes, do you need to be more careful? Yeah. So I'll be mentioning this in my Alzheimer's talk. If you're already healthy, do you need a ketogenic diet to stay healthy? Probably not. You need to manage your insulin and glucose, staying within whatever carb tolerance that allows you to do that. Some people, that's going to be 30 grams of carbs. Some people, it's going to be 150 grams of carbs. It couldn't hurt to try cycling carbs. Again, I've heard from people that it really works. And people that I trust, like other nutritionists that I think know their stuff, will say that for their clients, they do periodic carb refeeds. I support whatever works. I don't know why that would work. I believe it does. I would like to understand more why. And even the whole seasonal carb thing, that's true depending on where you lived. Because even, everyone, we talk about the Inuit, whatever. Even in the summertime, it's not like they were eating potatoes and fruit and apples. Maybe they were eating very, very small amounts of berries, whatever amount of greenery might have grown in the Arctic in the summertime. So I think it depends on where you're from, too. I don't know. Why would the thyroid be so sensitive to carb intake? Maybe it is, but I don't know why.
Could the calorie feeding work because satiety signal is different?
Yeah, so Christine is saying that when she eats keto, she struggles, her satiety signals keep her appetite down and she struggles to actually eat that many calories. If she adds a lot of carbs in, she can double, maybe triple it. I certainly could. And I find that I can not only eat more of them at one sitting, but I'll be hungry half an hour later. I could be eating on and off all day and, yes, consume an absolute ton as soon as I turn that carb switch on.
Yes, me too. I don't know the answer to that. It could be that they're eating more calories, but again, from other professionals that I trust and have no reason to disbelieve, they'll actually say, I increased my calories on keto, added a lot more oil, avocado, but pure fat though, not protein, not nutrient-dense food, just sort of empty fat calories, but upping the calories and still no change until they added the carbs. So I don't know. I wish I did have an answer, but I'm not uncomfortable saying I don't know. Whatever the mechanism is, it might not be known. And Chris Masterjohn, I'm a Yankee, I'm a Northerner, but I'm going to say bless his heart. he's brilliant. He is absolutely brilliant. No doubt about it. But I think he is a little too deep in the weeds and a little too micromanaging everything. And I don't know that that's necessary. I don't know what the answer is with the carbs. I've heard it from a lot of people that when they added the carbs, they felt better. And maybe it has to do, if it's somebody who does a lot of exercise, it could have to do with that. There could be something hormonally that we haven't identified yet. I don't understand all the relationships, but supposedly carb intake affects serotonin levels. That's why everybody feels better when they eat carbs. Maybe there's some kind of interaction there that I just don't know about.
And, you know, what works for you? You know, people try it and they say, well, I had a carb day and I suddenly dropped a load of weight and it's working really well for me. Well, great. If I have a high carb day, that could be the start of a massive avalanche back into depression and eating all the carbs. And suddenly in a month, you know, I can easily put on 10 kilos. So I'm not going to do it. It doesn't work for me. But if it works for you, then all power to you.
This is a question asking whether there is any benefit from taking MCT oil and other supplements on keto.
Yes, she's asking about supplements on the keto diet. And you specifically mentioned MCT oil, but are you asking about just supplements in general too?
Yeah.
They certainly don't work for me. MCT oil is a big no-no. We're talking disaster pants, so I stay completely away from it. Supplements. Personally, I don't think you should supplement unless you need to. So, you know, if you go and have a test and you're low in vitamin D, try and get more sunshine, see if it helps. If you need to supplement with vitamin D tablets, do it. Anything else you can think of, I feel the same way. You know, maybe some things like omega-3 people find useful to take, but I wouldn't supplement without finding out if I needed it first, because I think you can really end up reading the blurb on these sites and thinking, oh yeah, that sounds good. I take that, I'm going to get loads of energy, or I'm going to take this and my mood's going to improve, and you can end up just buying all the supplements and it doesn't really do anything for you except damage your wallet. So for me, I think, yeah, supplement if you need it, but otherwise, I wouldn't bother.
For me, I run the risk of a lot of the writing I do is related to different nutraceutical compounds and different vitamins and minerals and formula blends. And we have some doctors in the audience. They may have experienced this when they were in medical school. You become a hypochondriac. You read about some new condition or some new supplement. I need that. Oh my God, I think I have that. I get headaches. I must have this crazy rare disease. Like you freak yourself out. You think you need to take I need B6 and I need B12 and I need chromium. And, I do take supplements. I like supplements. Does everybody need them? No. Specifically with things like MCT oil and coconut oil, I don't consider those supplements. That's food, and I don't think most people need it. If you need therapeutic levels of ketones, maybe for Alzheimer's, for perhaps cancer, epilepsy, you know, I'm not sure. Maybe that's useful, but it's not a fat loss tool. It's not a weight loss tool. It's not a diabetes reversal tool like MCT oil. It's just fat. It's extra fat. Some people notice that they do get a cognitive boost, like if they put a tablespoon or two in their coffee. I've mainlined MCT oil, and I never felt any different.
That was my motivation for trying it too.
Different. I never had disaster pants, thank goodness, from it. But they say coffee's supposed to go right through. I could put an IV, and this is, I'm never going to. If coffee made you go, then the whole time I was hypothyroid, I would not have been constipated, because I drink like a gallon of this stuff a day. But I do use supplements. I try to use targeted supplements, and I do feel a difference. Maybe it's mind over matter, but I felt so awful for so long. Now that I'm feeling so good, I'm actually a little scared to mess with it. So I'm going to go with it until such time as I start to not feel so good again, and then I have to change things. But I do, I mean, I take a multivitamin, I take some other stuff too, but
how did you choose the supplements you took? Were you tested, or was it just with your knowledge and figuring out, okay, this is the problem. Maybe these are the supplements I need to take. So I'll try and I feel better. So I'll stay with it. What was your process?
It was a lot of trial and error, mostly error. a lot more error than trial. I don't know. I guess the multi, I look at what I eat and I just don't think that I'm getting all that I should get. To me, it's kind of like an insurance policy. But again, I don't think everybody needs it. I'm not recommending anything for anyone individually, but I like the multi. I take a high dose vitamin D that was recommended to me by an expert, and I feel better. But how much of that is totally placebo? I don't know. I'm willing to entertain the possibility that it's all in my head. I don't think it is, but it could be.
But it certainly can work. You know, I was very deficient in vitamin A, and the doctor gave me an oil-based supplement, and it didn't work at all. A friend of mine recommended I needed to take dry form. And while I was taking these extremely high dose, they even injected it, my vitamin A levels kept going down. When I started taking the dry form tablets, I got them back up into normal levels. So it obviously works when you need it. But personally, I do it to testing.
Yeah. And if you feel any different too, because that's the more important thing. The level could be changed, but the difference is how you actually feel.
It was completely on blood test results.
Yeah.
That's how I got the information. I had no idea I was that deficient.
Yeah.
Presumably I would have done if it had carried on.
Yeah. Because I say the same thing about thyroid, and it's probably true of almost any other metric you can have, unless it's, you know, blood pressure. They call it the silent killer, because I guess there's really no signs or symptoms that you have high blood pressure. But something like thyroid, I'm not a doctor, but I don't care what the numbers say. How do you feel? If you are wildly symptomatic, if you're coming to me and you're constipated and your hair is falling out and you're cold and you're tired and you're depressed, and your TSH is normal, and your T4 is normal, I don't care.
Find thyroid somebody is such that a will, good example
yeah,
for that, though, isn't it?
Find somebody that will help treat your symptoms and not treat your lab printout numbers. And the numbers are a guide. They're not useless. I think the numbers are important to corroborate the way you feel. The problem is just getting the right test that is going to identify the one or two or three that are out of whack.
Good point. Any more questions?
I have a question about exogenous ketones.
Yes, this is a question about exogenous ketones. And I've definitely seen them sold this way, that you can use them to fix a cheat. You can use them to get back into ketosis. I know that's a phrase you hate.
Kicked me out of ketosis.
But when you've got a load of sugar coursing around your system, and yes, that's something that worries me. What's, you know, is there going to be a problem with putting these exogenous ketones in when you've got high sugar in your system? That worries me.
I don't know what the consequences of that are, because exogenous ketones are a fuel. It's a food. It's an energy substrate, right? It's an energy substrate, just like glucose is, just like fat is. Why do we want to over, if your mitochondria are overloaded with glucose, why add ketones to that mix? Why not just have your carb binge and move on and no more carbs and get your body back to fat burning mode. Because here, it's all semantics. If your definition of being in ketosis is that if you pee on a stick or you test your blood and there's ketones, then yeah, exogenous ketones will put you into ketosis. Does that mean you are fat burning? No. It means you have ketones in your blood from an outside source. It doesn't mean you're breaking down your own body fat or breaking down the dietary fat to produce those ketones. Now, but the exogenous ketones, like some people, if they do a carb binge and they want to take that, maybe that helps prevent the ongoing cravings because maybe some of those ketones are getting into the central nervous system and fixing whatever craving mechanisms are in the brain versus the body. So I'm not totally against them, but I think they're very expensive. And I think they're unnecessary for most people. There may be targeted therapeutic uses, but to cover a carb binge, I think that's like the stupidest thing to do, but that's just my opinion. Yeah.
Big waste of money.
I mean, maybe I should change my thoughts, be like, start an affiliate, like, no, use the ketones and buy them from my website. I just make your own ketones the way God intended.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. We're here in Keto Fest. Have you got a Keto Fest top tip for us?
Keep calm and keto on, as they say.
Perfect.
The keep calm part is more important. Keep calm.
That's perfect.
If you weigh and measure and you want to freak out, do it, but try to balance it with also just breathing. And living. This keto is supposed to make your life better and easier and more fun. It's not supposed to make it harder and more difficult and fearful. And so it's not your job to save everybody else. Save yourself. Take care of your own health. Live by example. And there's a difference between being proactive and managing your health and letting it control your every waking thought. If you stay very, very low carb, that's like 90% of what you need to do. And it's, I don't know what else to say. There's a difference between taking care of yourself and getting to the point where your fear and worry actually works against you. Just eating very, very low carb, all that other stuff you're worried about is just sugar-free icing on the low carb cake. That just keeping carbs extremely low is responsible for the vast majority of the efficacy of this way of eating.
Well, thank you, Amy. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Thanks again.
To get the resources and links from the show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you want to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. If you fancy joining me on this exciting adventure and want to help me create new episodes, please go to my Patreon page at patreon.com/ketowoman or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. It's thanks to the two keto dudes that I'm hosting this podcast, so please consider heading to their Patreon page at patreon.2keto.com and help them bring you more podcasts like this one. Please help other people hear about and find this podcast by reviewing the show on iTunes and Facebook. Every star and review really does help. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support means the world to me. Thank you. This week's end quote is from one of the two keto dudes, Richard Morris. Come to Keto Fest to meet old friends for the first time. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.